Last week, I was visiting one of our members in her relatively new living situation in long-term care. Toward the end of the conversation, she asked me to write down my number at the church. She took a small but sturdy devotional book out of her nightstand drawer and told me to write the number in the back. Before she handed me the book, she took a large index card out of the front and said, "Ah, yes, I use this most days when I decide what I'm going to do." On it was a grid that I had seen many times, yet not for a number of years. It was what is commonly referred to as the Eisenhower matrix, or the urgent versus important matrix. Many of you are probably familiar with this time management tool. It's a four-quadrant grid, and in the top left-hand corner are things that are urgent and important. In the bottom left are tasks that are urgent but not important, and the top right are things that are not urgent but important, and the bottom right is not urgent and not important. Eisenhower was apparently masterful at time management and supposedly once said, "The most urgent decisions are rarely the most important ones." I suspect many of us would agree with that assessment. Urgent and important tasks are those that relate to issues that are in crisis, pressing problems and projects with a close deadline. These things should be done immediately. The urgent but not important are tasks that are essentially interruptions that should be delegated. Not urgent but important items are those which involve preparation and planning, new opportunities and relationship building. These are tasks that one should decide when they plan to do them. In the not urgent and not important category are busy work, time wasters, things that can be done later. I had some fun at the beginning of this week, put my lists into these categories, just to test it out in earnest instead of just theorizing it in my head. From this experience, I must admit to a few biases. First, I encountered difficulty in my perceptions versus the perceptions of others as to what is important or urgent for me to be doing. Most of you can probably relate to that. What if I recognize that something's important, but I don't think it's as urgent as somebody else does? Do I just tell them, "Listen, your email is in quadrant 3. You're going to have to wait a while." That didn't seem very pastoral, so I let my thinking move on from there, and I wondered if others were using this tool as well. How would I feel if my question went into the not urgent or not important category? When I was sorting my list, I noticed that I was trying to cram most of my list into the top two quadrants, important and urgent, and not urgent, but important. I didn't put anything in the bottom two boxes. I even hesitated to write anything in those boxes, the not urgent and not important box being the worst. Of course, those things are supposed to be listed just so you know to delete them and not to worry about them. This exercise got me to thinking about how we organize ourselves and our lives for discipleship. And what is urgent and important in our lives? What's the last urgent and important thing that you did? Answering an email? Checking your text messages, getting your children a snack, filling out your children's school paperwork, going to the doctor, reading the news, getting that last bit of work done before you fall exhausted into sleep, eating dinner with your family, setting up a lunch date with a friend, calling your mother. The question of what is urgent and important in the early church is a key component of the stories we hear in Acts. In today's passage that Mark read for us, the complicated nature of those choices leaps out at us from this story. When the disciples who are friends of Tabitha have cleaned and prepared her body after her death, go to Peter. They just realize he is nearby, and they want him to come. Peter is not far from Joppa, where Tabitha lived, and where her body is resting in death. They find him and say, "Please come to us without delay." Without delay. It's pretty clear that it's urgent and important that he goes. And yet, Tabitha is no longer sick. She is already dead, her body having passed from this life into the next. And so, what are her friends expecting from Peter? Most of the healing stories that we hear are framed to fit in this upper left quadrant of our discipleship matrix: important and urgent. But why this one? Were they asking him to come and pray with them, to offer comfort? Were they asking him to come and raise Tabitha from death, which is what he does? What did he think they were asking of him? And what were their intentions? It's not very clear. There is a prism of answers that I could make a case for each side. The traditional interpretation would be that this story is showing Peter's growth and leadership, that raising Tabitha from death put him in a league with the prophets like Elijah and Elisha in the Hebrew Bible, and Jesus, all of whom raise people from the dead. But oddly, none of these other stories present this urgency. In fact, in 2 Kings 4, the Shunammite woman will not send word ahead to Elisha about her son's death, but goes to him herself, even though it lengthens the journey and the time that her son is dead before Elisha comes back. Among those whom Jesus raises from the dead, the son of the widow of Nain, Jairus' daughter, and Lazarus, time is a factor in the latter two. Jairus approaches Jesus about his daughter while she is still sick, and as Jesus is making his way to her, someone from the leader's house comes and says that she has died, and adds, "Do not trouble the teacher any longer." Jesus, of course, goes anyway and raises her up. In the story of Jesus raising Lazarus in John 11, you might remember that Lazarus' sisters are very angry with Jesus for not coming sooner, even though they had sent word. In fact, the scriptures tell us that he waited for several days before he goes to Lazarus. He says so that God will be glorified. In other words, so that people will really believe Lazarus is fully dead and Jesus is able to bring him back to life. Jesus acts as if it is important, but not urgent. Over and over again, the disciples deal with this internal conflict of not only how to respond, but how quickly to respond. It is a type of conflict they watch Jesus deal with repeatedly. And how often did we hear the words on Jesus' lips, "My hour has not yet come," or when he gets a similar request to come to the bedside of Lazarus, who is sick unto death, Jesus waits before he goes to him. Perhaps Peter, here in this story in Acts, knows that discipleship works on a different matrix. That discipleship is not about sorting tasks or even completing tasks. In fact, our discipleship is about recognizing the importance of all four of those quadrants in the Eisenhower matrix. Because discipleship is a way of living. It is, in essence, the whole task list. Religious educator Courtney Gatto captures this tension beautifully when she says that paradoxically, Christian communities are sometimes playing in God's new creation, which has both a not yet and an already dimension. As people following in Tabitha and Peter's footsteps, we know that paradox of trying to respond without delay in a not yet and an already world. Dr. Gatto's work in this book is a theological argument for something that many of our mothers, including my own, told us with some frequency, which was, go outside and play. Her book is titled The Grace of Playing, Pedagogies for Leaning into God's New Creation. We don't talk about playfulness and creativity in discipleship nearly enough, and we try to force our lives of discipleship too much into those top two quadrants of the Eisenhower matrix. Sort of like that bumper sticker cliche, look busy, Jesus is coming. Discipleship is always urgent and important, but how often is it joyful for us? Can we allow ourselves to learn from our playfulness, from our creativity? In religious education, we call this the curriculum of leisure, and it is a vital piece of our learning, as vital as any part of who we are as disciples. Dr. Gatto makes this joy of discipleship very present by referring to us over and over again in her work as children of God, language that we'll use again very soon in our baptism liturgy. But it's not just imagining ourselves as children. It's imagining our work together as disciples as something we want to do without delay. But we achieve that by realizing that this discipleship has all of those elements. It is urgent and important in all of their dimensions. But it is in this tension of not yet and already where our discipleship takes root. Dr. Gatto describes this paradox a little more. At times, she says, the Bible refers to the kingdom of God, which resonates with the notion of a new creation. One of the Pharisees asks Jesus when the kingdom of God is coming, and he replies, the kingdom of God is not coming with things that can be observed, and nor will they say, look, here it is, or there it is. In fact, the kingdom of God is among you. A helpful way of imagining how the kingdom could be among the faithful already is to fathom that the kingdom of God is already within. In other words, it is within the capacity of human beings to constitute the kingdom of God by virtue of something innate that God has granted, by being children of God. This not yet and already dimension of revelatory experiences are theological ways of referring to what acting or believing as if is already attempting to describe in the language of playing. In responding to Tabitha's friends, Peter is acting as if he already understands the role of discipleship and what it already is and what it is not. In fact, the disciples are far from having any particular wisdom about the formation of Christianity at this point in the first century. Acts is the story of how they are figuring it out and how they are fighting and learning and playing in their discipleship in an effort to expand the ones who are followers of Christ. In Acts, as much as any place in the New Testament, the disciples are not yet and already. The revelatory experiencing of that paradox is what Peter and Tabitha's friends express so well in their actions. By Peter's willingness to just pick up and go with them without delay, not knowing what their expectations are or what will happen, it allows him to be present with them in ways that are perhaps beyond what they could have even imagined. And in their grieving, Tabitha's friends create an opportunity for the unexpected. There is little doubt that God's new creation is among them. Sometimes we hold too firmly to the urgent or the important parts of our discipleship. We are not yet disciples in so many ways, and we are already disciples in so many others. We want to assert our already qualities, the things we do without delay, and confirm our point of view. In other ways, we lean into the not yet part of our discipleship. We tell ourselves and others that we're not ready for that yet. In fact, the joy of our discipleship is that it is a vocation where we are always already and not yet people. There are things we can already do, and there are things that we can't do yet. There are things that we need to do without delay, and not because they are important and urgent, but because they are just part of God's new creation. Being an already and a not yet people, we have the unique ability to hold the joy and pain of the world in our hands and in our hearts. We live into our discipleship as if the new creation is within us. And like Tabitha, like Peter, and like the disciples around Tabitha, we don't know what to expect next. But we do know this with confidence. There is joy in both exploring the not yet and embracing the already, because in both, our discipleship is all that it needs to be.